640 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. In Chicago, film and TV actors are going on strike at midnight Pacific time after talks with studios broke down. CBS's Christopher Cruz says some 160,000 SAG-AFTRA members are joining almost 12,000 film and TV writers who've been off the job since May.
Hollywood studios now face their first dual work stoppage in 63 years, forcing them to stop many productions across the United States and overseas. The actors are demanding increases in base pay and residuals in the streaming TV era. Actor and union member Mehdi Barachian, who calls himself a middle-class actor, tells CBS News it's now tough for people in his position to make ends meet.
It used to be such that you could make a living. I'm not talking about red carpets and champagne. I mean just a standard American living by working on television.
Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
Federal health officials approved the first over-the-counter birth control pill called O-Pill. CBS's Janet Shamlian with more.
This is unprecedented, and it is a game changer for reproductive health care. The easier access is likely to have the biggest impact on tens of millions of teen girls and lower-income women who may not have a doctor.
Triple-digit temperatures have become common across portions of the country in recent weeks. Extreme heat has been lingering in Texas and Arizona. And Central and Southern California will get a taste of it this weekend. Palm Springs is expected to be above 100 degrees. John Summers, who is homeless, tries to stay cool however he can.
I just use water, you know. I basically just use water, you know, as much as I can. And hit shade and, you know, the mall, wherever they let you in, you know.
CBS's Scott McFarlane has the latest in the classified documents prosecution of former President Trump.
Special counsel Jack Smith, who's prosecuting the former president, has asked the judge to set jury selection in the case for December 11th, 2023, and to reject Donald Trump's defense team's request to push this all back until after the next presidential election. The special counsel says such an open-ended delay has no basis in law or fact.
About that bag of cocaine found in the White House near a visitor's entrance, the Secret Service says, case closed, no leads or suspects. CBS's Nicole Skanga has more from the White House, where Republicans briefed by the Secret Service are by no means satisfied.
The Secret Service has a canine unit that screens for explosive devices and biohazards, but not illegal drugs. And for some lawmakers, this incident now raises questions about security protocols at the White House.
Bail is set at $1.2 million for Larry Pickens, who is charged with killing hand surgeon Dr. Benjamin Mock in a suburban Memphis clinic exam room on Tuesday. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For WAUK The Shaw, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. A former Waukesha first grade teacher is fired. Melissa Temple was let go after a long hearing yesterday. Temple got in trouble with the school district for criticizing the school district's decision to ban the song Rainbow Land from the spring concert at Higher Elementary School. The school district says the song was inappropriate. Temple says she's a victim of censorship. A Waukesha bus driver faces sexual assault charges. Prosecutors accuse Michael Meyer of sexually assaulting a girl with special needs on several occasions. Investigators found almost 1,300 text messages between Meyer and the alleged victim between 2021 and as recently as last month. Prosecutors say he also made the girl watch pornography and had illegal pictures of her on his phone. Meyer was in court yesterday, where his bail was set at $1 million. I'm Terry Bell, and this is WAUK News.
Attention, Wisconsin veterans.
Hello, I'm Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. If you are a veteran struggling to pay for rent, utilities, or other life-sustaining services, I want you to know that the Veterans Rental Assistance Program is here to help. You have already made a most noble sacrifice. You shouldn't have to continue doing so. We are here to support you. The Veterans Rental Assistance Program was created by and for people living in Wisconsin, with benefit approvals being issued to veterans in just days, not months. It's never easy to ask for assistance, but rest assured, we're here to help. You've always been there for us. We want you to know that we're here for you. Call 833-WISVRAP. That's 833-947-8727, or visit VRAPWI.com. On behalf of the state of Wisconsin, thank you.
This summer, 540 AM WAUK has a new lineup.
Yes, that's awesome.
Starting at 6 AM, Up North News, 8 to 10, The Earl Ingram Show. Mondays, 8 to 9, Under the Helmet with the Grave Digger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crute. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show on 540 AM. WAUK.
About it. We need to be talking about it more. All these things actually have an impact.
Yes, they do. Talk to everyone you know about it. Drive them crazy just the way we drive you crazy. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here in the exhibit hall, Netroots Nation, as you're coming into the exhibit hall, there's a display of all of the banned books. And yeah, we're doing that. Yeah, you know, the Misery, Moms for Misery, that group doing their best to make sure our kids don't see, well, those books. And there's a huge display of them. And the sad reality is, you know, I read most of those when I was in school. So they're basically banning my high school years. And how much worse is it going to get? Not only are they trying to ban books, they're trying to destroy public education as a whole. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how we don't let that happen. I've asked Randy Weingarten to come talk with us. She's the president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course.
So did you see the display of all the banned books?
I saw the display from the Freedom to Learn, and there are several displays of banned books, which in some ways shows you the energy on the side of knowledge. So Kim Crenshaw's group has the display in the hall. Move On has launched their banned book bookmobile that's going to 10 different cities in the next 10 days. And what you're seeing is Moms Rising has done a poll of moms, and almost 80% of voting moms are really opposed to this banning of books. You see that same kind of polling from NPR, from others. So what's happening is this group that calls itself Moms for Liberty basically represents a few people. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't represent anybody, but they are funded by the group of people who hate public schools, Betsy DeVos, the Koch brothers, the Uline brothers, all of those kind of billionaire class that have been trying to voucherize and charterize and undermine public schools for a long time. And what they did was they have exploited and weaponized the anxiety that lots of people have in the post-COVID environment, making sure that their kids are okay,
sure,
and their families are okay.
They've stoked that fire.
They've stoked that fire. They've demonized. So instead of trying to solve people's problems, they've tried to stoke that fire. And so, but what you're seeing now, and you and I have talked about this a lot, so a year after you asked me that question the last time we were at Netroots, what's happening now is there's a huge number of people who are really opposed to and really uncomfortable with book bans.
Right.
Does that mean that if there's a book that's inappropriate, there's a process in virtually every library. The American Association of Libraries has a process.
Sure.
There's a process in every school. So there's always these processes for voice. But when you know that 11 people are responsible for 60% of the book bans in Florida, and those book bans include the poet Amanda Gorman, her poem that she read during Joe Biden's inauguration, for that poem to be banned, for a book about Roberto Clemente to be banned, a book about Ruby Bridges to be banned, a book about Anne Frank to be banned, you know this is an assault on knowledge and an assault on freedom, and people are rising up to fight against it.
But interestingly enough, Mein Kampf is still on a lot of bookshelves.
Interestingly enough.
And it's just a weird kind of juxtaposition, if you will.
Well, because...
But I know why the Amanda Gorman piece has been... Because it's anything having to do with Joe Biden has to go. It's got to be bad.
But think about this. Hitler was antithetical to, I would hope, most people. I do know that Moms for Liberty at one point or another
did use one of his quotes.
Did use, and it took them a while to understand that that was a problem, but they finally did apologize. But let's take Mein Kampf, or let's take any other of these completely horrible manifestos that dictators have done. I would argue we need to have those books on the shelves because you need to understand what they are.
Yep.
And it's a good teacher that can help navigate through things that are conflictual. So what these people who are trying to ban books are doing is they're just banning knowledge. And instead of, it's not about freedom, it's actually about thwarting freedom, and it's actually about indoctrination. So they are doing exactly the opposite, or they are doing what they accuse us of doing. And the last thing I would say, and I said this to you at one of your other shows, and I said it when I had just come back from Ukraine, is that the propaganda war that they do and the amplification that they have is so bullying and so toxic that what happens is that people then don't speak up.
Violence works.
And it really, and so that is, if you listen to or read any historian about the history of fascism or authoritarianism, the first things they do is bully and ban books. Those are the first two things they do because they want to isolate people and create fear and thwart knowledge.
And I would argue, you know, create their own narratives. And I did catch some of the Moms for Misery, Moms for Liberty group, whatever you want to call them, the new Tea Party group. I did watch some of their things, and they had the Lieutenant Governor from North Carolina on there. He spoke, a guy named Mark Robinson, I believe his name is. And he was saying that, you know, we need to have all those quotes because we need Hitler and Pol Pot and Castro, and we need all these quotes. And I'm going, you know, I don't disagree that you should learn about them, but chosen quotes that you use for your own current narratives, that's not education. No. That's indoctrination. That's the grooming that they're accusing you of doing.
Correct. I mean, it's, you know, it is when you really believe in knowledge and that kids, I root for our kids. I wonder why these indoctrinators are so fearful of knowledge that their kids have. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be age appropriate. Of course we have to be age appropriate. But it is shocking to me that they have so little faith in their own kids that they think a book by Amanda Gorman is going to turn their kids away from something. A book about Ruby Bridges or Anne Frank or Roberto Clemente, it's like it doesn't, for a teacher, you just look at that and say, what is going on here? It seems so basic that we'd want people to understand and appreciate differences between people. But it is, you know, it is a book banning, bullying, those, you know, creating apathy, creating isolation, those are all the tools of the autocrat.
Now, you know, what's interesting to me is, you know, I've known my kids' teachers, you know, especially when they were younger. We used to go in and volunteer in the classroom and all of that stuff. And I know what they were learning because we participated in it. How much of this ramped up fear machine is playing on the reality that we're busy lives. It takes two and three incomes for families to survive. And a lot of people don't feel as they are as connected to the classroom and what their kids are learning as they want to be or should be. And they're looking at these groups as maybe being the policemen that they're not. Do you see anything in that?
Look, I always think that there is a seed of truth in everything.
Right.
And, you know, something would not have the fuel and the energy, even though it's a small group of people, it wouldn't have the fuel and the energy that the 1776 Project and all these other groups that, yes, were funded and formed by, you know, right-wing billionaires, but they're still people as part of it. So, so I think what's happening is a few things. I think, yes, you're right. People are really busy. There's so much information out there and misinformation out there. It's not like when Walter Cronkite was on, and you just presumed, you gave Mr. Cronkite the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You just presumed he was right. You presume that the news source that you got was right, and because the law required that there be some policing of disinformation in the airwaves, you assumed at least the facts were right.
Right.
I think what's happened now is it's busyness, it's the bombardment of so much information and such contradictory information and real attempts algorithmically through social media to create divide, anxiety.
You got that right.
So people don't get the benefit of the doubt anymore.
But shouldn't that be, I come back to, I know my kids' teachers. Mm-hmm. I know they're not indoctrinating and grooming my children as is being, portrayed by these groups.
But I think when you actually do polling, parents of school-age children actually are far more supportive of teachers than people who don't have school-age children. Parents of school-age children are far more supportive of their own individual schools.
Their own. So somebody ask you that question.
So, but what that says is that in this age of anxiety, division, fear, and disinformation, the most important value we have to have is trust. And so so the same kind of trust you had for your kids' teachers, Rick, most people have for their kids' teachers. That's why, Moms for Liberty is a small group. That's why Take Parents Together, which is another parents' platform. They have 2.5 million people on their platform. Moms for Liberty, they say they have 200,000 people. They say they have 200,000 people, and look what Ron DeSantis has done to try to, grow them.
So they got money. They got lots of money.
So I think what's happened is, you think about their conference in Pennsylvania. There were a lot of people outside protesting them. There were over 200-300 people outside protesting them. I don't know how many people they had inside.
I had a friend get thrown out.
But, you know, I'm not so sure they had more people inside than the people outside. So what I'm saying is they got a big megaphone, but most people still trust their kids' teachers. We have to have a way that parents and teachers both have voices in curriculum. We have to make sure that books are age appropriate.
Right.
And frankly, if somebody is really uncomfortable with what a teacher's curriculum is, that parent has a right to talk to the teacher, talk to the principal. You want to create that transparency because that transparency creates trust.
Right.
But what has happened, like what the Virginia governor did, is they weaponized it and otherized it in places where people, you know, where people don't have kids.
Right.
In rural areas where, you know, they had elderly people who were there, they were trying to fear monger.
Or even if they do have kids, you know, to highlight what I was going to ask you a minute ago, because, you know, people go about Congress. You know, my congressman is okay, but the rest of Congress is terrible. So it's the same kind of view in my
Correct.
Teacher's great. My kid's school is fabulous. My kid's school is it's all of those other ones to highlight your
because
point.
Because since the age of Reagan, I mean, sorry, I am a social studies teacher. I have to bring history in. If you think about what has happened in the United States, take FDR to Reagan. Depression happens. Hoover does a terrible job. Lots of anxiety, lots of pain. FDR gets elected. Not everything he did worked.
Right.
Not everything the Congress did work. Remember, the Supreme Court tried to stop it all. Last time we had that kind of runaway Supreme Court. But he got the benefit of the doubt for trying. And then for literally 30 years, because 30 years, there was real faith in government. So it was because of the actions that that president took in light of the pain of the Depression. He said, we're going to get over this. And then America, World War II, beacon of democracy. But then you get to Reagan, who, even though he was positive, I mean, it's kind of ironic, Reagan, the last SAG president, the last person to be the president of SAG in the last actor's strike, who then went totally out, you know, hated unions, hated government. He's the president of the United States. He's hating government. He's hating institutions. He's undermining institutions. So you have since the early 80s, how many years is that? 40 years. So 40 years of people believing in government, now 40 years of undermining these institutions. And part of the problem we have, and Tim Snyder and others say this, is that if people don't believe in the institutions of democracy, labor movement, government, frankly, the FBI,
yep.
Supreme Court, public education, then what happens? What happens to regular people? And so I think what you're seeing right now, which is what's really scary, is the powers that be, and you see it in Putin's Russia, you see it in China, you see these gazillionaires, these oligarchs. You saw it with Steve Bannon. You see it with Trump. Churn, churn, churn. Divide, divide, divide. So then who's left? The oligarchs. And that's what is the most damaging and dangerous, because it means that regular folks don't get a piece of the economic pie. It means that the 90% of kids that go to public education, what's going to happen if the systems get all voucherized? Where are they going to go? Who's going to make sure they get a well-funded education? So part of what we have to fight for is not just talking about the book bans and how bad Moms for Liberty is and whatever, but frankly, We have to make public schools again the center of community, the center of pluralism, where people of all ideological ways, actually, when it comes to schooling, when it comes to their kids, there's an agreement that we're going to go for the best interest of our kids.
You know, I often use the quote that's attributed to Jay Gould, that he could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. And I argue the billionaires aren't even paying us anymore. They're just funding these groups to keep us at each other. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. You know, kind of last line of questioning I want to get into you with is, you know, we've talked about all these problems. We've talked about all this. You know, how do we change this? I mean, we're at this event. The idea is, you know, of a couple thousand fire-breathing do-gooders coming together. You know, what's the marching order out of this in moving us away from what I fear we think is coming is more chaos, more division, mm-hmm. especially in 2024 with the presidential election, if Trump is at the head of it. You know, where do we go? What's the way forward?
So you've heard me say before, I'm going to say again, we are in a race between hope and fear, between aspiration and despair. And frankly, thank God we have a president of the United States who understands that and has done everything in his power to try and make the economy fairer and the democracy work in a way that everyone is respected and where, and I'm using his words, not mine, where the economy grows from the bottom up and from the middle out. And I think we just got some really good news this week that, with the exception of Florida, because Ron DeSantis doesn't care about homeowners in his home state, and they have the highest inflation in the country, and virtually no one can get home insurance anymore, and he's done nothing to help that. So with the exception of Florida, what's happening is that inflation has really tumbled.
Right.
And what we are seeing is some endurance and stability in the economy, because it's not just that inflation has tumbled, it's that we're having a manufacturing renaissance. So you tell me, I mean, you had Sherrod Brown on. How many times did Tim Ryan and Sherrod Brown and me and others say, we need an industrial policy in the United States? That's what Joe Biden has given us.
Yeah.
And so we're making it in America again. We're creating pathways again. So what do we have to do? We got to make sure that opportunity is broad-based and real. We got to make sure that people can have a pathway to the middle class. Call me old-fashioned. We need to have a pathway to the middle class. We need to make the middle class cool again. We need to make sure that schools are centers of community where we bring everybody in. And that we actually do respond to the real needs and issues of parents. We can't shy away from the fact there is learning loss because of the pandemic. There are mental health issues because of social media and the pandemic. So, schools people, us, we have to create strategies to address that. And over the next couple of weeks, that's what I intend to do. Starting with reading and then going to things like hands-on learning, wrapping services around schools, because that is part of our job, to grow, to rise a generation of kids. And if we can create an economy that recreates the middle class and rise a generation of kids, then I think you're going to see joy and confidence again in America.
That's, you know, the, as I say all the time, the idea that if you work hard, play by the rules, that you actually do get ahead is something we need to do. Last, SAG-AFTRA just went on strike. Writers Guild's on strike. Any thoughts?
I said this on Twitter and on Threads today. Love that Threads, even though, you know, I got a lot of issues with Facebook and Meta.
We're in the same boat.
But what is it with the studios who don't understand that it is the people who have created the profits for them? And this is the same kind of robber baron argument that we saw in the railroads a century ago, where it's the people that create the profit and the studios as we have new technologies and new streaming, do not want to share that profit with the people who created the profit for them. And so, you know, this is personal for me. My son-in-law is one of the writers on strike. And we're going to do, as a union, everything we can to support SAG, and as we have done everything we can to support the writers.
No, I have no doubt that that being the case, but we're with them 100%. Randy, as always, great seeing you. I appreciate you taking some time for us out of your busy day, and I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks.
Our good friend Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of your teachers? And, you know, book bans? Are we in favor of that? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1863. That was the day that draft riots broke out in New York City. The Civil War had been raging for 2 years. For the first time in United States history, the government instituted a draft lottery. But for those with enough money, they could buy their way out of the draft. For $300, or more than $5,000 in today's money, you could remove your name from the lottery. This meant that the city's working-class men, many of them Irish Americans, had to fight while the wealthy could stay home. Anger in New York City mounted. The anger was stoked by anti-war newspapers and politicians. The newspapers railed against the war and the draft. They also riled up fears that more black Southerners would come to New York because of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Black men were exempted from the draft because they were not citizens. This further fueled anti-black anger amongst working-class whites. On the second day of the draft, violence erupted. First, the rioters targeted government facilities, but then they turned their wrath on black New Yorkers. White dock workers destroyed dance halls and boarding houses that served black patrons near the docks. A mob burnt down an orphanage for black children, but fortunately the children escaped. 11 black men were lynched. President Lincoln sent federal militia to New York to quell the uprising. After 4 days of violence, the official death toll rose above 100, but the true number is unknown. The Martin Scorsese film Gangs of New York dramatized the draft riots. To this day, class continues to be a major factor in who fights and dies on the battlefield.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
About 150 years ago, General Philip Sheridan was sweltering in the relentless heat of a Texas summer. He was not happy. "If I owned Texas and all hell," he groused, "I would rent out Texas and live in hell." Summer has always been hot here, but 2023 has been something else, thanks to a hellish heat dome that has been baking us since late spring, sending daily temps up to 116 degrees. But worse, a more punishing heat has hit us from an even stranger, unnatural dome, the Texas State Capitol. That's where our malicious governor, Greg Abbott, and his GOP majority of extremist right-wing lawmakers rigged the rules to make life easier and richer for corporate elites and much harder for working people. In this year's legislative session, they rammed a nasty piece of plutocratic meanness into law that critics dubbed Death Star. It annihilates the basic right of local officials and voters to govern their own cities and counties. In particular, it empowers autocratic state officials and even corporate executives to nullify decisions by localities to protect workers and others from corporate abuse. In a cruel case of bad timing, the first local law targeted for nullification by the Texas GOP is a humane requirement in Dallas and other cities that developers provide 10-minute water breaks for construction workers. This in a state with America's highest rate of heat-related deaths and presently suffering biblical-level heat. Triple-digit temperatures kill, yet Abbott, his air-conditioned legislative cronies, and his corporate campaign donors whined that a required water break was, quote, an oppressive burden on the extraordinarily rich construction industry. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's a new rule I'd like to see. No lawmaker or lobbyist is allowed to oppose heat protections for workers unless they spend July and August with no air conditioning for themselves.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Netroots Nation here in Chicago. As we, I think this is about the 10th one of these I've been to. And every time we come to them, it grows bigger. I'm always encouraged to go. There are a bunch of fire-breathing do-gooders out there that are going to change the world, going to change the narrative, and maybe help us move in a more positive direction. And one of the groups that I came across here at the big Netroots Nation is the folks at the Center for Popular Democracy. I think we've had people on from the Center for Popular Democracy over the years. But I'm sitting here with the co-executive director. His name is DeMario Cooper. DeMario, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem. Happy to be here. Really excited.
So real quick, what is the Center for Popular Democracy?
Yeah, so the Center for Popular Democracy is the largest grassroots power-building network in the nation. We have 48 affiliates in 38 states, including D.C. and Puerto Rico. And we work on issues everything from health care, housing, criminal justice reform, democracy, trying to protect democracy, especially in this time, and, you know, workers' rights, economic justice.
Now, an event like this, kind of a good home for you, I think.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. This is kind
an
of
opportunity
our,
to...
Absolutely. It's a networking play. I mean, we've been calling it a family reunion almost. You know, it's like all these folks who've been working together in different spaces for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years are bumping into... Like, I'm meeting friends that I haven't seen for 10 years here. So it's really great.
No, that's it. Exactly. Look, I've been doing this show 18 years, and I know people through social media. People email me. You know, we have these, we've built these relationships over the years.
Yeah.
But you come to a place like this, you get to put a face to it. In fact, you know, just a couple minutes before we started,
yeah,
someone I haven't seen in you know, got to be 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can see it. You two, you're connected. Like, the history y'all had together seems like y'all done worked on some things together. This is like that kind of place where we can network with other progressives and people who are actually out here fighting a good fight. So it's really good to be here.
Now, ultimately, coming out of this, you know, you're gonna build some power, build some strength, and move the country in a different direction. You brought up evangelical, right wing, white nationalist, Christian kind of thing, which should be, other than if you're Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate.
I mean,
you should be, you know, kind of against that. No.
Well, I mean, I think, you know. Yes, absolutely. The rise of like this white Christian nationalist wave that is like using kind of post hoc ergo propter hoc arguments, meaning we're going to talk about critical race theory and that we're going to make that a big deal, a big issue. When in fact, we all know like that is not something that's happening in elementary school.
But it's critical.
Right.
And it's a theory.
Right.
And it's about race.
It is about race. Like those three things.
That's enough.
It's bad. That's bad.
That's all you need to know.
Yes. Yes.
No, I've been saying this for the longest time, and you're so spot on. You use scary language.
Yep.
You use, you know, oh, it's critical, and there's a theory, and
that's right. Watch out.
Be afraid.
Be afraid.
And that's all the right really has is their daily dose of outrage candy.
That's right.
And their daily dose of fear.
Yes. I mean, they're the masters of fear, right? Like the idea of really wedging working people, right? Like with what I feel like the other side, which at this point I'm not even talking about conservatives anymore. I actually think we're talking about the rise of a new Confederacy, right? Like the Confederacy is trying to reemerge in our society right now, and they're using fear and dog whistle politics to wedge working people.
Are they using dog whistles?
Well, maybe not anymore, right? Like
no, because here's the thing, and this is. For me, this is what I think Trump was most successful at.
Yeah.
He made it okay to put the dog whistle back in the drawer.
You know, that is a really important analysis. That's part of what we're saying where we're like, oh, the politics of now have changed. Like things are different.
Because I think we've always had these people.
Yeah.
I mean, you go back to 92 when Pat Buchanan ran, you know, the Molly Ivins quote of, you know, his speeches were in their original German were better given than.
Listen.
So this isn't new stuff, is it?
No, it's not. No, it's not.
It's just now that there is someone who's come forth and said, it's okay.
That's right.
You can say those
things that you couldn't say before. You can say them now, and it's okay. That is a part of what we're dealing with. And I think also what we're dealing with is the skittishness of the Democrats. Right? Like not having a race conversation. Right? Like we need to lean into this conversation. Instead, what we are normally told are, you know, don't talk about that. You'll alienate white people. Don't talk about that. You'll alienate voters. But what we're finding in all of the research is that actually white folks understand what's happening. Right? Like it's not all of the white folks, but there's a chunk of white folks who are like, that's racist. That's wrong. That's not democracy. They're trying to steal our democracy. In fact, people, you know, think about this. You know, the group of folks that tried to raid our Capitol are somewhere calling themselves patriots. Like they get to have that narrative.
No, you're not wrong.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I believe.
And the thing that got me is they're the people who wave the flag the highest,
yeah.
And yet they were stabbing policemen with flagpoles with the American flag on it.
Yes, like defecating inside of the state capitol. You know what I mean? Like, but they're the patriots.
Yeah.
Not us who are saying, let's fight for what the Constitution says.
Right, but they've labeled themselves that. The rest of us can look at them and go, no, you're seditious traitors.
Right.
And yeah. this is where the majority of people coming together and speaking out, I think, has a need.
Yeah.
And the silent majority does need to finally put these people, because we were talking with Randy Weingartner earlier about these maniac moms for misery.
Yeah.
And how there's a very small number of them who are extraordinarily well-funded.
Yeah.
They get the most bang for the buck possible.
That's
They're
right.
out there screaming at the top of their lungs.
That's
but
right.
the majority of moms, they want sanity.
Yes.
They want their kids to get a decent education.
A full
they
education.
Want to learn, exactly.
The thing is, like, we're talking about basically burning books. Right. Like we're at this phase of like you can't read that book. You can't read that book. You can't read that book. But all we're doing is ill-equipping our kids to be able to move inside of a global society, inside of the world, you know. And so, I love Randy, by the way, but I completely agree with this. Like we cannot continue to make ourselves dumber, make our kids dumber, like hiding information from them and not being honest about our history. When we think about like, you know, they say, if you don't learn your history, you're doomed to repeat the same mistakes, right? So,
and there's some people who want us to read through.
Exactly.
And this is where I get to. Look, I believe there are people who, you know, they're in the camp.
Yeah.
They're ready for the second coming.
Yeah.
You know, they want the next revolution to be all about. We're gonna go back to the original intent of the Constitution. You know,
yeah.
Women in the kitchen.
Yep.
Blacks in the fields.
Yep.
Gays in the closet.
Yep.
That's what they want to return.
That's right. That's right.
And I grew up believing in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
I may not agree with what you do or what you say or all that.
That's
but
right.
It doesn't matter.
Pursue your happiness.
Do your thing.
Yeah. Just as long as you're not hurting me.
There you go.
That's it.
See,
most of us feel that way. Though.
That seems simple.
That's the thing. Most of us feel that way. Most of us feel that way. When you think about, you ask anybody what are the things that you want? You want to make sure that you're safe, your family's safe. You want to have a good job to take care of your family, and you want to send your kids to a school that's going to educate them to be able to do things that you couldn't and better things, right? Like to innovate and be successful when they grow up. All of us want that. All of us want that. The problem we're dealing with is that some very wealthy people, the same people that exploit workers, has convinced half of the workforce. Let's remove race. I don't want to remove race because you can never remove race.
Right.
But even if you just think about workers, right? The people who work, the people who produce, the laborers. If I can wedge the laborers, those who are wealthy and the corporate who are exploiting our labor can continue to do that, right? Race is one way that we do it, one way that they do it, right? Like they wedge with race. They say, oh, you have more in common with me. There's a white person who is working a job, making minimal wages with no protections, no labor, health care protections, right? Like we're looking at something in Texas where they're talking about people can't get water breaks, right? You know, and this person, because they have white skin, think that they have something more in common with Donald Trump than they do with
me. You're spot on. And look,
it's crazy.
There was a railroad magnate from the 1880s. What was his name? Oh, yeah, Jay Gould.
Gould.
A guy who said, I could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half.
That's right.
Whether he actually said it or not, you know, is up for dispute. The guy who wrote his autobiography, angry with me for repeating that. But it's attributed to him. But it's the same idea.
It's the same idea.
If we can split people up, male, female, white, black,
yep.
blue collar, white collar, green yep. collar, pink collar, ring around the collar, we yep. can rob them blind.
We can rob them blind.
And this is what the Tea Party did masterfully, and this is what all this stuff is doing masterfully.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what we are on our side is, you know, we're thinking about how do we build relational power, relational organizing? How do we create an analysis for working people, poor people that is not running from race. It is including race. Because throughout history, as I was on the panel, I was in a panel earlier, and it was Nina Turner and Keith Ellison and a guy named Terrence Woodbury and Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the person who really, like, this critical race theory thing came from. She was facilitating a panel. And they were basically like, we're in this point where if we continue to not build things together and think about how we work together and we run from race and we don't talk about the fact that, like, every white person in history wasn't bad. Like, there was a John Brown who sacrificed his life and his children to this mission of us being more human together. Because it's beyond, like, race stops us from being human together.
Right.
Right? Like, this thing is about actually cutting us off from being a certain way with each other. And if we let it continue, it will continue to wedge us. The opposite of that, as Martin Luther King said, is love. Right? Like, we actually have to learn that we have more in common with each other, and then we have to build power and strategy from that place.
Right.
The truth is what you said earlier. Most people in this country agree with what you said earlier, which is like, that ain't really my thing. Why do I care about what those people are choosing to do, as long as it's not hurting me? That's most of us. But we're quiet, and we feel like those moms, the crazy moms, and the crazy, wild religious extremists, which, by the way, a Christian religious extremist is the same as a Muslim extremist, right? Like, they're not different. They both kill people.
I keep saying Christian Sharia law is just around the corner.
Yeah. Oh, my God, Rick.
No, but am I wrong?
I think that's what we're fighting
That's why we're fighting like hell right now. That's the reality. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with DeMario Cooper. He's the co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy, popularDemocracy.org, the website. Easy for me to say. You know, but here's the thing, and I come back to this. You know, in 2015, we did a civil rights tour with the program. We went anywhere where Black people were treated poorly, we went.
Oh, that's awesome.
So the idea was, it came out of my oldest daughter came home from school, and it was, you've had these conversations. What'd you learn today? Yeah. Oh, we learned about Rosa Parks. What'd you learn? She was tired.
I know, it drives me crazy.
So we here at the program said, you know what, let's do a little educating. Let's go and find actual history. So we went to all of the places across the southern U.S. where Black people were treated poorly, which is now a tourism industry.
Yeah, it is. Because
there's an institute here and a center here.
That's right.
And, you know, wonderful presentation of history. But we went through and we taught our kids, you know, this is what happened.
Yeah.
This is the kind of stuff. This is where we come from. This is what education is. Now, understand, I'm going to tell you right now, I didn't do it.
You didn't do?
It wasn't my fault.
Oh, yeah. I mean.
And this is where I tell my white friends, you didn't do it either.
Yeah.
It's not your fault.
Not your fault.
Learn from history. Don't do it again.
Don't do it again. Don't participate in perpetuating the thing.
How hard is that?
But you know, it is this. Our country has created a condition where we can't even explore that as the truth, right? Because as soon as you say, "Oh, there was enslavement. People were enslaved." This is the thing
people
about
throughout
this,
the history of humanity have been white people were slaves.
Absolutely. This
black
is a particular,
people owned white people.
That
I mean,
was a thing.
This happened.
This, but the thing
I
that happened in
it.
America is a particular thing.
Yes.
It is a little different. But here's the thing. Most of my friends, I'm from Akron, Ohio, right?
Like, I grew up in Cleveland.
Oh, good, man. You know what? I keep saying Ohio people are the best people in the world. I find you all everywhere. We are found everywhere. We never are in Ohio. We don't stay. That's an interesting thing. The conditions there may not be. But either way, I love my state, and I love people who come from that state. But, you know, there are people there, and I have to say this to my white friends. I'm always like, look, the facts of the matter is it is highly likely that during the time of enslavement, your family did not own a human. It is more likely, especially if you're in the South, you're trying to compete against free labor.
Right.
If you lived in the South during enslavement, you were a white person who had a farm, you got to try to beat this mega farm over here with all these people working for free.
To your point, when we did our tour, we went to historic Stagville, which is a plantation in Durham, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who was a curator gave us an incredible tour. And she took us to one of the slave quarters, which was, you know, well-constructed, you know, solid building. She said, look, the slaves here lived in this quarters. They were fed this many meals a day. This is the medical care they got. They were cared for. Now, caveat.
I mean.
They were treated like animals.
Yes.
And they were tools. Yes. So that's the reason the owners treated them well.
That's right.
But on the other side of the fence, there's a shanty hut. where the white people lived,
competing,
who didn't get fed every day,
yeah,
who were starving, yet they still thought somehow they were better,
yeah,
than the slaves. So it was this weird world.
Oh, yeah. That's Lyndon B. Johnson. Eat Jim Crow.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, as long as I can say I'm better than you, I'll eat
so
all
the
Jim Crow.
So how did they divide those people to go, look, you're the same. You're both at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
How do you not come together and say that's the guy?
Yeah.
The guy living in the big house.
I mean, because, you know, there's the old saying, like, these people, we act like crabs in the barrel, all of us or whatever. And no one ever stops and says who made the barrel.
Right.
Crabs aren't supposed to be in a barrel. Crabs are supposed to be on a beach, you know, like plenty of room to move. But when you put people in these pressure cookers, right, people are just trying to get out. They're trying to survive. That is a human condition. The thing is, if I can point to those people and say they're the problem and get you to agree to it, then I can continue to do it. It's like with your little brother or sister when you're growing up and you're eating something good, and then your little brother or sister says, can I have some of that? You're like, this is nasty, right? Like, this is disgusting.
My kids do that to me every day.
Exactly, right? I think we're being subject to that thing in mass, which is, you know, we could have this, we could have a beautiful multiracial democracy. There's a future for us in that way. A popular democracy that we all can thrive, and, you know, we keep these corporate giants in check who act like vampires, right? Like, they don't die. They have an agenda that's 150 years old. It's going to outlive all of us,
yep,
right? We could create something where we could protect ourselves against those types of entities. But what happens is, you know, when we talk about this idea that doesn't exist, those craps who are like, no, I'm getting fed right now. I'm getting this little crumb for this thing.
Yeah.
You know, then it's hard for us to go that way. But the fact of the matter is, our work, our organizing, what the Center for Popular Democracy is doing, is actually spending time with people. Because it's not like you can send somebody a piece of paper during an election to help them have a political analysis around what they should do. And you can't send somebody a tweet, just be a random tweet, and think that that's going to move them into being a progressive and active person. That takes time. You have to spend time with people. You have to talk to them. You have to find out what their interest is. And then you have to, like, actually invite them into a space that is collective and building power and really serious about building power, right? So, I mean, that's the work we're doing. It's a long fight, but it is not in a vacuum. We are in a historical struggle, you know? I'm one who likes to say, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't vote. I don't participate in politics. I say, well, you know, politics decide who gets what when. And, like, you
that's
know,
it.
People, you
eighth
know.
Grade, my government teacher in eighth grade, that's what he said.
That's right.
And
that's a good way to say it.
At the end of the day, those exact words.
Politics decide who gets what,
yep,
and when they get it.
And he used to say, don't bother voting. Mm. I don't want you voting.
Mm.
Makes my vote more powerful.
That's right.
And I get what I want.
That's right. Oh, that's a great teacher.
It was the radical self-interest that he played on.
Yeah.
And this is part of that.
That is.
The radical self-interest. Yes. How are you going to be able to support your family?
That's right.
But this is the weird part of the world that we're into, Mario. We've got a politics now where people are looking at others and going, as long as you're doing worse, I'm okay with that. As long as I'm not doing, I'm not doing well either.
Yeah.
But as long as you're doing worse.
Because
we did a tour back last October and November where we went to places that used to be. You know, Akron, Ohio used to be the rubber capital
of the world.
Toledo used to be the glass capital.
That's right.
Eau Claire, Wisconsin used to be rubber. I mean, there were all these places through Iowa and Wisconsin, and where people were struggling, and they were getting by, but they were voting on, we're going to make other people's lives worse.
That is so, yeah.
And
yeah.
That's my problem with where we are. So last line of question I've got for you, how do we move away from this and start moving towards, how do we make all of our lives better?
That's right.
How do we make this a better place? And
that's right.
Talk about, how do we go after the guy who made the barrel?
So, I learned a long time ago, government's not the problem, it's the prize. If you win it, you get to move your agenda. If you lose it, somebody else's agenda, your own defense. You know, I think part of what we're struggling with now is realizing that the folks who are marginalized in our society are actually the margin of victory for us to get the football.
There you go.
That's it.
No, it's interesting that you bring that up and phrase it that way, because Ronald Reagan told us government's not the solution, it's the problem.
Yeah.
But the right has done everything they can do to take over government.
Think about that. And you know, Fannie Lou Hamer always said when there, she's like, I don't know all of this voting thing, but I know if these white people are fighting this hard for me not to have it, it must be something good for me. You know, like,
they're I got 1,000 of those.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, man. It's really, yeah, I think what we have to do is start, you know, honoring each other and actually engaging each other and find those folks who are at the margin, help them understand what the situation is and bring them into the fold. Like,
there
get them off the side, put them in the middle. Let's play. Let's really get to it.
DeMario Cooper, I appreciate you taking time for us. You got to come back and talk to us again.
Oh, I will. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been great.
Outstanding stuff. Right. DeMario Cooper, co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy. You can check out their website, populardemocracy.org. Quick break. Right back here from Netroots Nation in Chicago. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day that revolutionary black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois helped found the Niagara Movement. It was named for the mighty current of change the group hoped to bring about. The initial organizing meeting was held near Niagara Falls, New York. During the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, African Americans had an unprecedented level of freedom. They were also involved in politics, winning elections for local and state political offices. However, when Reconstruction ended, those gains were quickly rolled back. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the more prominent African Americans who opposed Jim Crow laws, which strictly enforced racial segregation in the South. At the organizing conference of the Niagara Movement, the group drafted a Declaration of Principles. Foremost among these was a demand for voting rights for black Americans. Another principle concerned labor rights. The declaration read, "We hold up for public execration the conduct of two opposite classes of men. The practice among employers of importing ignorant Negro American laborers in emergencies and then affording them neither protection nor permanent employment, and the practice of labor unions in proscribing and boycotting and oppressing thousands of their fellow toilers simply because they are black." This point recognized that the refusal of many unions to include black workers limited black economic opportunities. Managers pitted workers against one another along the lines of race to undercut worker solidarity and power. The Niagara Movement continued until 1908. That year, a race riot by white residents of Springfield, Illinois, the hometown of Abraham Lincoln, left 8 black residents dead. In response, Du Bois founded an interracial organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which still exists today.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. As we wrap up day one here at Netroots Nation, hope you're enjoying our coverage of the big powwow here in Chicago. I got to tell you, DeMario Cooper, there's somebody we're going to have back from the Center for Popular Democracy. And the idea that, we should be having these hard conversations. We're not doing any of this stuff now. None of this stuff is actually happening society-wise, but it should. It has to. In order for us in the working class to finally come together. And I think the analogy that he used, you were talking about the crabs, and we're not talking about the barrel maker. We're not talking about the system that keeps poor people down regardless of race or gender or whatever. We're not talking about any of that. And that's right where the rich people want it. That's right where the entrenched interests want us to keep focusing on the things that, the things that tear us apart. And look, as a union guy, and look, there's a lot of things that, you may or may not agree with that we're going to be talking about over the next couple of days, and that's okay. And I think we've got to be able to say that that's okay. Maybe you don't agree with it. But ensuring that people have the ability to pursue that life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And you heard DeMario talk about that. That the vast majority of us believe that as long as you don't infringe your rights on mine, you can do it. You do whatever you need to do. That's where we should be pursuing. Sadly, what we see from the other side, and again, as we talked earlier with Randy Weingarten about, the idea that the moneyed interests are propping up these small number of people who do have some concerns. I don't think all of the Moms for Liberty folks are insane. A lot of them have been fed the outrage candy. I think a lot of them have been put into a position where, we all want what's best for our kids. And the right knows this. The right knows that they can, if they feed enough outrage candy to us, that people are going to get upset.
And it's tried, tested, and true. So am I surprised that we're back to banning books and that the burning books are probably coming soon? Not really. But it's the rest of us. It's the sane, the rational. It's everybody else who should be going, we're better than this. We're not going to allow this to happen and continue. And you know, I look at the display of the banned books. And I got to tell you, I never thought this would happen in my life.
You're listening to The Shah. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.